offended by that. But imagine that you're a movie script writer and you get the opportunity to make a pitch to Steven Spielberg. And so you pitch this story. Once upon a time, a young man came to Jerusalem, the center of life for the one people that worships the only living God. He doesn't seem to be anything special externally. He's not especially big or good looking. His education doesn't go beyond the average Jewish man's. He doesn't come from a prominent family. He doesn't have a status job. His hometown is not well known. Those who do know the town don't think much of it, because among the Jews, even the region that his town is in is despised, because it represents the mixture of the Jewish people who are supposed to be separated from all others. And in this area, there are several races of Gentiles, and the king of the region is of mixed races, and he's very immoral, yet he claims to have accepted the Jewish religion. But yet this young man who comes from there comes into Jerusalem as if he owns the place. The people love it. However, he alienates the business community by interfering with a lucrative business in the temple. He alienates the ruling political party by exposing their religious error. They have rationalistic arguments to prove there could be no resurrection. He alienates the political party of the people by exposing their wrong attitudes. They claim so much love for God's law, and yet they ignored the greatest commandments. The people love it, but they lack the character that it would take to save him from these powerful forces which have become thirsty for his blood. So with the help of one of his closest allies who turned traitor, he is arrested without a charge. Well, a charge is trumped up through the twisting of his words. No one defends him. His closest friends are too scared to admit that they know him. And he is then taken before the ultimate regional authority under this false charge, and his enemies ask for his death. No one defends him. He won't even defend himself. The one in authority knows the young man is not guilty as charged, but because he is more concerned about his own life than he is about justice, he gives in to the will of the mob, which the corrupt Jewish leaders have managed to sway to their side. He is killed, murdered by the system. Proof, once again, that evil reigns. Truth and justice are not enough to overcome it. But then, in a surprise turnabout never before witnessed in the history of the universe with its natural order, this young man is no longer dead. He is alive. Truth and justice prevail, and they all live happily ever after. What a great story. It has all the elements of great drama, action, intrigue, suspense, a message, and a great surprise ending. But it's so much more than that. Well, without the last three verses of Matthew, this whole gospel is nothing but a great story. For the people in the story, it would be more than that. But for us, without the last three verses, it would just be a great drama. So let's pick up this, and then the kids are here now for a class. After this, the kids will be dismissed to their classes. But let's pick up the story at Matthew 28, just to get the point here. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. But when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. We're actually not going to get to those last three verses. So let's go ahead and go to the classes that are prepared for the kids. All right, those who want to go. So boys, if you want to go, you can go. Okay, so then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. Now, stop right there and think, what would this mean for us? Sure, these followers would do what this guy said. I mean, he was more powerful than death itself. He told them to meet him on a mountain in Galilee. They met him there. They'd be scared to death of what might happen if they didn't go along with what seemed to be happening. At the same time, I think we'd have to expect some doubts. Some did. They would be inclined to go along with what they were seeing and hearing and even touching. But since this was totally unique, they couldn't fully trust their own senses and experience. But here's the question this morning. Why are we affected by their quandary? We never saw him before or after his death, not like they did. So what is in the last three verses of Matthew makes the whole story relevant for us? Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you." Because this young man told his followers, and he is a young man, he's half my age, by the way. I just realized that this week. Jesus may be 35, I don't know. But because this young man told his followers to go and make disciples of all nations and to teach them to obey everything he had commanded them to do as his first disciples, we have received the news about not only his life, his death, and resurrection, but about its power to change us, not just them. Jesus commanded his disciples to go and teach others to obey everything he had commanded them. So going and teaching others was one of the things he commanded them to do. So every follower of Jesus, every disciple obeys that command. It wasn't just for the 11 who were left after Judas had betrayed Jesus. So that is how we have come to know this story. But not only to know it, to be affected by it. As we look at this passage, we generally focus on the obedience to the command he had made for disciples to obey. And we in Churches of Christ have also emphasized the one that he implied when he says to baptize the disciples. And those are good things to emphasize. But I wonder if we have missed the parts more related to why we obey those commands. Therefore, teach. Well, that word therefore is very important. It suggests that what follows is the main idea. So if you hear a therefore, listen to what comes after it. I want us to look at what Jesus said before he said therefore, though. Why did the disciples go? Why did they baptize? Why did they teach them to obey everything that Jesus commanded? Well, let me skip to the chase. As disciples, we will go and make disciples. If we are followers of Jesus, we will go and make followers of Jesus. It's a fact. But why? Well, first, we obey Jesus because of his authority. Jesus said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go." I said, look at what follows it. You look at what comes previously. Okay, so the basic meaning of authority is the right to do with one's property as he or she wishes, right? That's your authority. In other words, we're putting our fate in Jesus' hands. We belong to him. He has the power to do whatever he wants with us. The power to create or to destroy, those are the extremes of his authority. But what comes in between? How will he use us now that he has created us, and if he does not intend to destroy us? If we really do grant Jesus the authority which is rightfully his, what will be the result? Humility, contentment, serenity, tranquility, peace, resolution, security, calm, temperance, purity, so many other things that most of us lack, at least to some degree, can only be found in submission to Jesus' authority. That is, these qualities will characterize our lives on the inside only through trust in Jesus. Now, you can find all of these things externally in many ways and places. You can find peace and tranquility as a hermit in the mountains, for example, for a while, at least. And then comes winter, or a storm, or a grizzly bear, or illness, or loneliness. The peace that is found through trust in Jesus is one that is not destroyed by external factors, whether persecution or loss or any other troubles. An extreme example of the power of this trust is found in Richard Wurmbrand's story. We read a little bit from it once before. He was that Lutheran pastor who spent 14 years in communist prisons. In one of the prisons, they tried to brainwash the Christians. They did some kind of silly things. At one point, they presented a play which consisted of anti-Christian propaganda. And after the play, Wurmbrand was allowed to respond. Well, he responded by preaching Christ. Well, later, this is what happened, reading from his book, In God's Underground. Lieutenant Konya came to bring me two pieces of news. First, he said that my wife was in prison and had been for some time. Second, that I was to be flogged at 10 p.m. that evening for my repeated defiance and insolence culminating in my speech at the play. The news about Sabrina, that was his wife, was a terrible shock, and my pain at the thought of it added to my fear of the beating to come. We all dreaded this period of waiting. Time dragged and then passed all too quickly when I heard footsteps coming down the passage. The tramping boots went by. Someone was taken from the next cell. Presently, I heard blows falling and screams from the room at the end of the corridor. Nobody came for me that night. Next morning, I was again warned. For 6 days, the suspense was maintained. Then I was led up the passage. The blows burned like fire. When it was over, Lieutenant Konya, who supervised, shouted, "Give him some more." Then I was slow in getting to my feet. 10 more, said Konya. I was half carried back to the cell where the loudspeakers were blaring, "Christianity is stupid. Christianity is stupid. Christianity is stupid. Why not give it up? Why not give it up? Why not give it up?" My pages are flipping. Sometimes beatings were administered by the warders in the cell, other prisoners, for minor irregularities. When the guards became bored with beating, they grabbed a couple of prisoners. They said, "Slap your friend in the face." If the man failed to do so, they said, "You've lost your chance," and told the second man to strike the first. He'd hit out blindly, now hit him back, and they struck at each other's faces until blood flowed and the guards roared with laughter. Now, listen to what Wurmbrand wrote in the preface of the book. "The prison years did not seem too long for me. 14 years. For I discovered, alone in my cell, that beyond belief and love, there is a delight in God, a deep and extraordinary ecstasy of happiness that is like nothing in this world. And when I came out of jail, I was like someone who comes down from a mountaintop, where he has seen for miles around the peace and beauty of the countryside and now returns to the plain." Now, compared to what many followers of Jesus have suffered and do suffer still today in our world, don't the minor irritations that get us down seem small? I mean, if we just can't seem to accept our job or the place that we live or the people in our lives or whatever it is that gets us down, aren't we failing to say, "All right, Jesus, it's your business what you do with me. Just show me how to do the best I can for you in this situation"? See, it can be these little things that seem like big things, but they keep us from making disciples wherever we are and wherever we go, because we're focused on ourselves and our own problems. If we recognize his authority, we can stop trying to manipulate our circumstances and just do what he says to do wherever we are with whatever abilities and opportunities we are given. But there's something bigger than ourselves to help us obey this command. Jesus said, "And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." Those are the last words in the Gospel of Matthew. We obey Jesus because of his authority, but how do we manage to do that? Well, we are able to obey Jesus because he is with us. While it is true that Jesus said this specifically to those first apostles, the way he said it makes it very clear that he is just as much with us as he was with them. We are really powerless without him. So if you'll allow a play on words, Christmas presents are fun, but Jesus' Easter presence is empowering. He is with us today. Now, his presence with us today is probably not manifested through prophecy, inspiration, and miracles as it was through the apostles, but he is here just the same. He said that he would be present to the end of the age. And the age won't end until he returns for the last time. At least that's the most plain meaning of teachings about the end times. So we can be sure that Jesus is with us today. The end hasn't come. He will always be with us. So what does his presence mean? How does it help us obey him? Well, in our immaturity, it helps in at least two ways. First of all, his being with us, his presence helps us to helps to enforce his authority. I was usually not a disobedient kid. I didn't think of myself as a disobedient kid, but matches were a big temptation for me somehow. And one day, my friend Robert came, and we had to wash, dry, rinse the dishes. We had took turns, and I was drying that day, and Robert comes in. He had found a penny. Now, this is how old I am, but in those days, a penny could buy several things, but the two things that we were most tempted by at the grocery store down at the corner were banana bikes. Banana bikes were these caramels that you got two for a penny. So, penny, that was good. The other thing was matches. You could get a little box of matches for a penny. And so he came in and said, "I got a penny," and so I got down with him, and my mother was standing right there. She said, he said, "Let's go down and get some matches." And, he whispered, but my mother, I think, heard him. She said, you're not going to go buy matches, are you?" "No, we're going to go buy banana bikes." I actually lied. It's one of the few lies I can remember telling to my mother. We did. We went down and we got matches, and we ended up setting on fire this whole area next to our house. And, if we had just been open about it, there's no way that I would have been disobedient, told a lie and gone and done something that I knew that we weren't supposed to do. So when your parents are there, you're at least going to think twice about disobeying. We are all immature enough at times that we have to remember the threat of punishment in order to do what we really ought to do out of love and appreciation. Now, hopefully, the need for this motivation lessens as we grow older in Christ. However, we still need for Christ to be there, even if we do mature. Because you know what? We should always view ourselves as children, even when we act with the authority of Jesus as we grow. And we can do that. But another way his presence is with us is important is that it provides us with strength and consolation. These are things that we will always need. We're never going to outgrow the need for strength and consolation, because the stronger we grow, it seems the greater the trials and temptations become. I think this is really the emphasis Jesus is making when he says, "I will be with you." Now, if we understand him correctly, his presence is not a threat. It is a promise. Now, hasn't this command, though, to go and make disciples made you feel small and weak at times? Doesn't it sometimes make you feel like a failure, maybe even a disobedient child? Don't you feel guilty for not doing more? Well, the reason that we feel that way is because we're viewing the instructions as a threat. Those feelings are not necessary. What it takes to not have those feelings is to remember that everything doesn't depend on us. We can't save the world by our own power and genius. We aren't that strong and we aren't that smart. Jesus wants us to depend on him, his strength, his wisdom. There isn't one of us here Think about this. Who wasn't helped by someone who taught them in some way about being a Christian? You know, maybe it was a preacher, but it was more likely a parent or a teacher or a friend. But not one of those people didn't make mistakes as they taught you. Some of them did more wrong than they did right. And yet, here you are. Why? Because Christ was with that person. He was in that person. To some degree, your teacher or preacher or your parents or your friend allowed Christ to be revealed. This means that you also don't have to be thoroughly competent as a teacher to obey Jesus' command. You will make mistakes too, but he'll be with you. Maybe in the form of another person who can help teach, or maybe he'll even grant you wisdom. I'm certainly not saying that it doesn't matter how we go about trying to share him. It does matter. It's extremely important. However, you can be very skillful at teaching and still be ineffective if you lack the humility that comes from believing that Jesus is with you. He's the one providing wisdom and effectiveness. Remember what Jesus' brother James says about this. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. Then down in chapter 3, verse 13, who is wise and understanding among you? Who's gotten this wisdom? Let them show it by their good life. You don't have to have a lot of words. You don't have to be a good teacher in the sense that we think of teachers. Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. Do what you can when you can and trust God to give the growth. And then you can live without guilt. We'll always be sorry that some are lost and that we made mistakes and that we missed opportunities. But we'll know that failures and successes are in God's hands. So let's just be thankful that we can have a part in his glorious plan. Our friend who's passed now was teaching a Sunday school class in Montana when we were there many years ago. And something she said caused a light to turn on in the mind of one of her students who had sat in her class many times before. I'm sure her student's eyes widened as she said, "You mean all these stories are true?" Well, yes, that young man's story that we started with is true. And it is so much more, though, than a great drama for us. But only because he told his disciples to go and make disciples, and they did. And then those disciples did, and those disciples did, and those disciples did, until the message finally came to us. Are people in America becoming less religious or more religious? There are conflicting reports on that, even today. But will this story be more than a great drama for others in the future, regardless of whether there are fewer worshipers today than there were in past generations? Well, it's really kind of up to us, but only in the sense of letting Jesus use us as he sees fit. And if we'll do that, he will be with us and we'll make disciples. So now we are going to celebrate the communion. And this is something that they did together a while before these last verses, but not that long. While they were eating, Jesus took some bread and thanked God for it and broke it. Then he gave it to his followers and said, "Take this bread and eat it. This is my body." So let's pray together as you peel back the one lid and take the bread, and we'll